you're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Arman Rana.
I'm Zachary Tharp.
I'm Ben Nelson.
I'm Violet Miles.
And I'm Isa Yu. It's Thursday, November 14th at 5.04 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hinkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Later in the show, we check in with a union spokesperson on the recent proposed changes to VSB cafeterias. Now for local headlines.
Okay, so a bit of an unfortunate story today. So longtime Canadian broadcaster Don Cherry was fired this past Remembrance Day for xenophobic comments. On his world-famous Coach's Corner segment, when talking about a lack of Canadians purchasing poppies, he stated, "You people love our way of life, love our milk and honey. At least you could pay a couple of bucks for poppies or something like that. These guys paid for your way of life," when referring to soldiers, "that you enjoy in Canada." The comments obviously sounded like they were aimed at new immigrants and not at Canadians in general. The comments have stirred up a massive and contentious debate over whether they warranted his firing from Sportsnet. Personally, I think this final controversy was the one that broke the camel's back for Cherry's career after other previous contentious comments. I think it is highly unlikely people would have batted an eyelash if he left out the "you people" tirade and just said Canadians. I think that had he said Canadians, he would have been sending a message that was more positive and easy to agree with, to support our veterans. But that's not how he expressed himself, and it's ultimately why he's out of a job. Cherry is 85 and has been on Coach's Corner since 1982. Cherry is really no stranger to controversy in general, whether it was calling David Suzuki a left-wing kook on air while expressing doubts about climate change or being extremely negative towards European players. In 2004, he was critical of protective visors on hockey helmets. He said that only European and French players would wear them, insinuating that he felt that European and French players were softer than Canadians. This story is yet another example of sports and politics mixing as well as oil and water. I don't care for Cherry's views on hockey. He encourages a tougher game with more fighting. I prefer hockey that is pacey with less of a spotlight on grit. These are the debates that should be happening on air. These are the talks I want to listen to when I watch Coach's Corner. The future of Coach's Corner is now up in the air. This will be a strange time for Canadian hockey broadcasting. A spot on Coach's Corner has not been available since the 80s.
Thanks for the sports update, Ben. So, transit strike. There's been a transit strike recently. And earlier today, negotiations between the Coast Mountain Bus Company and Unifor have fallen apart. According to CTV, the negotiations lasted around an hour and a half between both sides parted ways. Unifor has announced that bus drivers will begin to refuse working overtime starting Friday, and Unifor's chief negotiator, Gavin McGringle, did I say that right?
McGurgle,
stated that the refusal to work overtime could result in a 10 to 15% disruption of services. The CUPE 7000, which represents SkyTrain workers, have recently announced contract negotiations with BC Rapid Transit Company, who operates the Millennium and Expo lines on behalf of TransLink, have stalled and are meeting to decide on future action.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. It's interesting that you mentioned the transit strike, because on my way to the studio at UBC Bus Loop, I encountered several union representatives handing out flyers and pins in support of transit workers to students. So they seem to be quite well attuned to the court of public opinion. On that note, Zach and Violet, you have an update on the frats?
Yes, we do. About a week ago, the Alma Mater Society, AMS, voted and decided to remove IFC's club status and release a report about the details going forward. This comes after a nearly month-long debate whether Greek life, especially fraternities, have a future here at UBC. To refresh our listeners, we have who haven't necessarily heard about what's going on here at UBC involving fraternities. On October 1st, Dr. Marina Adche tweeted that 6 women were drugged at UBC fraternities here on campus.
And the university responded to these allegations with an investigation through the RCMP, which the Sexual Assault Support Center, better known as SASC, has openly denounced, asserting that it does not align with survivor-centric principles, which is actually new information to me. I didn't realize that SASC had denounced that.
And I spoke with Dr. Adshade a few weeks ago, and I asked her if fraternities could coexist with the university, and she responded saying that fraternities should stop being single gender for them to really exist here and be, you know, more or less safe for all genders present. When it comes to the AMS, the Interfraternity Council, IFC for short, apparently was said essentially there was no chance of future compliance according to their bylaws. Overall, removal of IFC as an AMS club will allow AMS to have more authority in keeping IFC accountable. The report also includes the possibility of having the AMS Advocacy Committee in charge of keeping public accountability for IFC and Greek life moving forward.
Some of the specific reasons that the AMS found for severing ties with the IFC were the unauthorized collection of membership fees, the fact that it routinely allowed the use of controlled substances in violation of its own constitution, and due to its constitution's restriction in which its members must be male identifying. This was found to violate AMS Operation Committee's Policy Manual Section 4, which states membership in all AMS clubs shall be open to all active AMS members. And of course, this would render all female members of the AMS unable to join the IFC. IFC leadership has acknowledged that their constitution and bylaws are non-compliant in several areas and unlikely to change, though they contested some aspects of the report, such as accusations of substance abuse. Regardless, they agreed it would be best to run their organization separately but collaboratively.
While the frats may not be going extinct just yet, something else might.
Yeah, so UBC Extinction Rebellion is holding die-ins at the UBC Nest from November 12th to 15th at 12 to 1 p.m. every day in protest of UBC's investment into fossil fuels. Extinction Rebellion, as quoted on the website, is an international apolitical network using nonviolent direct action to persuade governments to act justly on the climate and ecological emergency. The three demands listed are weirdly enough specific to the UK, but here they are. Government must tell the truth by declaring a climate and ecological emergency. Working with other institutions to communicate the urgency for change. Government must act now to halt biodiversity loss and reduce greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2025. Government must create and be led by the decisions of a citizens' assembly on climate and ecological justice. And now we're going to play an interview recorded by Zachary Tharp from today's die-in.
What's going on and like what all this is for?
Absolutely. So my name is Liam Gannon. I use him, he/him pronouns, and I'm a member of Extinction Rebellion here at UBC. We're a nonviolent direct action civil disobedience group. We're a grassroots organization led by students, faculty, and staff. And right now, we're calling for UBC to divest. UBC has followed a 6-year campaign asking for divestment. And what divestment is it's basically taking this a philanthropy-funded endowment fund, which currently UBC has $120 million invested into fossil fuels, and it's withdrawing that from the fossil fuel industry, so UBC is no longer a contributor to the climate crisis. There's been a 6-year student-run campaign trying to convince UBC to divest. There's been 2 referendums where UBC has voted both faculty and staff in majority of favor of full divestment. And still this year, they're only looking at partial divestment. So Extinction Rebellion, we're now running an escalation campaign with the goal of putting pressure on UBC as an institution to divest.
And what is this, like, die-in that's going on?
Right. So a die-in is a method of action that's used to try and evoke a lot of emotional response from people. The stark contrast of people going about their day while there's a bunch of what appears to be dead bodies lying on the ground, which is the point of a die-in, it sets that kind of stark emotional contrast and it draws attention to the issue. And so that's why we're doing a die-in. It's kind of like a sit-in, but we believe it has more emotional power.
That was an interview with a member of Extinction Rebellion here at UBC conducted by Zachary Tharp. So the Food Services Working Group has proposed some cost-cutting measures related to cafeterias and the Culinary Arts Program. I caught up with Bill Thielemann, spokesperson for the IUOE Local 963, the union that represents cafeteria workers at Vancouver School Board schools. Let's take a listen to what Bill Thielemann had to say. Speak with us today. To start off, could you just tell us who you are?
So it's Bill Thielemann. I'm spokesperson for the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 963, and we represent Red Seal chefs, cafeteria workers, and others at the Vancouver School Board.
Yeah, so you mentioned the
IUOE Local 963.
Yeah. And your role is as the spokesperson there?
That's correct.
Yeah. And could you describe the recent proposed changes by the Vancouver School Board Food Services Working Group and what your interest and the interest of your union is in these changes?
Sure. Well, the Food Services Working Group is a management-only group that came up with what we call some very drastic cuts to the culinary arts program, which is what students take in high school to learn basic food service, restaurant, and other skills that you would use in the restaurant or food service or hospitality industry. So if these cuts go through, it would dramatically reduce the number of opportunities, educational opportunities for these students across the city, and it would mean literally tens of thousands of Vancouver students over the years ahead would lose their chance of learning skills from Red Seal chefs for a trade that could last them a lifetime.
And so I just wanted to tie it back to the union. Like, I understand that it's going to have a negative impact on these students. How does it affect the workers that you represent?
Oh, well, yeah, our union represents Red Seal chefs who teach the students these skills and also represents cafeteria workers who also prepare meals for students. And that's one of the other cuts that was proposed to reduce the number of cafeterias in the schools in Vancouver.
I see. And you referenced, you tweeted last night the Food Service Working Group consists entirely of managers and did not seek any mm-hmm. input from key Vancouver School Board stakeholders. You also mentioned that earlier in this interview. What is the Food Services Working Group and what is their mandate in relationship to the school board?
Well, they are comprised of senior managers. There are no stakeholders. There are no representatives of our union or other unions, such as the teachers' union involved. There's no students. There's no parents. It's simply senior managers at the school board. They've made these recommendations to the elected trustees of the school board who now have to deal with this. But the way that you should properly do a consultation and make a plan is to involve people who are directly in these trades, who are the teachers and the Red Seal chefs who actually teach students, and talk to students and parents and talk to the restaurant and food services industry, which our union has done but the school board has not done. And then you develop a plan and you base it on a lot of the input you've heard and the information you've gathered. This has been done completely in isolation. It's simply a cost-cutting exercise that does not has not in any way consulted the Vancouver public who depend on schools to train their children.
Could you talk a little bit more about, you mentioned earlier the impacts on students. Could you just flesh those out a little bit? You mentioned the hot meals programs. So how would those be changed going forward if this was implemented?
Sure. Well, just to be clear, there's three aspects to the cuts that have been proposed. One is to the culinary arts program, which teaches students for potentially a career in the restaurant food service industry. A second is the non-teaching VSB-operated cafeterias, which supply, you know, hot food and nutritious food based on the BC food program, some of those would be also closed. And then thirdly, they would eliminate the hot meals that are provided to students in need. So we all know that if students arrive at school hungry, they can't learn, that it's a real impediment to learning anything, not to mention to suffering. And so we have a fairly sophisticated hot meal program for breakfasts and lunches, and that would be eliminated, and it would be replaced by, in this proposal, by delivered food. So it would be cold food, centrally prepared probably somewhere, and then delivered to the schools where there are students who have indicated a need. We're also quite concerned that that would stigmatize children, because they would be identified as, which they're not in a cafeteria setting, they'd be identified by a food delivery, and so everyone would know that they're having problems or they're in need. And I don't think that's the kind of thing you want to encourage in a school setting. You don't want people to stick out like a sore thumb because they have challenges in their home and their economic situation. So there's those three different concerns. But, you know, taking away a hot meal and replacing it with a cold meal is just not something that we should be looking at this point, when clearly I think the public supports helping students in need.
Yeah. I wonder, you mentioned the fact that culinary arts programs would be cut. Are there alternative ways that other courses that students can take? And I think there was a statistics quoted that there's going to be no culinary arts program west of Main Street or something like that. I was wondering, is there other courses or other programs, not the culinary arts program, that students can still learn, you know, home economics and like learn how to cook? Or are all cooking classes no longer would no longer be available to students?
Well, the culinary arts program right now is already restricted, and our union had actually approached the school board about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and said, let's try and expand this program, because we know that right now the restaurant and food service industry needs 20,000 people across BC, and it's growing. If you look at the labor force projections for British Columbia, they need 11,500 chefs alone over the next 8 or 9 years. So instead, this is going the opposite direction, but right now there are no teaching cafeterias west of Main Street. So anyone on the west side of town who wants to take these courses already has to bus or drive or get transported back and forth to the schools that offer them. And that shouldn't be happening in our city, period. But the restrictions, or sorry, the cuts that have been proposed could reduce the number of teaching cafeterias down as few as two. And that would mean an incredible difficulty for any students who want to learn this. It's not the same as other courses, so there is no replacement for this. And of course, it's our public school system. If students wanted to learn restaurant and culinary trade skills, they would have to go to some kind of a night school or a private college or something in addition to going to school. And that makes no sense to us when, you know, we're training, you know, 800 to 1,000 students a year in these programs. To take that away and dramatically reduce it at a time when the need for new workers in the industry at every level, whether it's chef or sous chef or servers and hostesses, bakers, all of these things are in demand. Why would we reduce the number of people who are getting those skills rather than increase them and meet the demand?
So I recall when I went to high school like 5-6 years ago at University Hill Secondary, there was a kitchen. I didn't take those courses, but there was a kitchen where mm-hmm. students took courses there and learned how to cook. So are you saying that that has already been discontinued?
No, there are no there's no culinary arts program teaching cafeterias west of Main Street now. So there have been a number that were eliminated over the past several years. And, you know, a lot of this is around cost cutting and trying to make economies. But, you know, it has to make sense. It's not just dollars and cents. And part of this also, we don't say math programs or social studies programs or English classes that, you know, they should make money or they're too costly. For culinary arts, this is something that for many of these students will be their career. They'll go into that. And for other students, it will allow them an opportunity to get perhaps first jobs in the restaurant business in Vancouver. There's also students with special needs. Many of them have gone through the culinary arts program, and it has allowed them to get a first job and have the ability to have pride in a job and do something, you know, in their off school times with the training that they've had through the culinary arts. So there's a lot of benefits to these programs, and they really shouldn't be cut.
All right. So I listened to your interview earlier today on CKNW with John McComb. And as you mentioned mm-hmm. today, that a lot of this seems to be a cost-cutting measures. At the same time, you mentioned it's not a provincial government issue. So I was just wondering how you reconcile those two.
Well, the province provides funding for schools, no question about that, but it doesn't provide direct funding for individual programs and say the yay to this one, nay to that one. Those are the decisions made by the Vancouver School Board. So the Vancouver School Board has a budget, and they decide how to allocate the funding. So that's why it's not like the Victoria is deciding which programs stay or go. That's a decision locally here in Vancouver.
But do you believe that, do you think the Vancouver School Board would be going on such a cost-cutting kind of exercise if they had the budget to, pay for all these things? That's what I'm kind of...
Yeah, well there's always challenges for school boards across the province in terms of making their... they have to, by law, have to balance their budgets, and that's always been a challenge, and there's been issues here in Vancouver. But what we're talking about really is a relatively... minor amount for the school board budget is almost $1 billion. One of the reasons why we believe this is being driven is because cafeteria equipment is getting old and needs replacement. They have no capital replacement and repair plan. That's one of the recommendations in this report, to create one. And it kind of makes you wonder what's going on at the school board that they don't have one already. But the total that they've identified in this report is just under $5 million.
The savings.
The amount to actually replace cafeteria equipment that needs replacing over the next few years is about $5 million. And $5 million on a $1 billion budget is really a rounding error. That to us does not make any sense, given the impact it would have on students and on the opportunities that they have in the system.
So what would you estimate? So that would be if they went ahead and continued as normal, they would have to pay that $5 million to replace that equipment. But by reducing this offering, they would cut the cost and they wouldn't have to pay that? Is that what you're saying?
Well,
their thought process is?
They proposed three things. Basically, all of these are cost-cutting measures. So reducing the size and scope of the culinary arts program, so offering less student placements and having fewer schools offering it, closing some of the school cafeterias, which would also lay off our workers who work in cafeterias who aren't teaching students but are providing food for students, and then third, going to cold meals instead of hot meals in the schools for students in need.
I see.
And those are all cost. Those are all cost.
And what would you
measures.
Estimate those the total value of those cost cutting measures to be?
Well, that hasn't been articulated in this report, but obviously they're looking at saving hundreds of thousands of dollars, I would presume. And also, I think part of this is just having less management of these programs would presumably be easier for the school board, but it wouldn't be the right thing to do.
Okay, I see. As we speak, there are a lot of other kind of union kind of job action talks and negotiations mm-hmm. breaking down with the provincial government directly or indirectly. For example, with regards to education, the head of the BC Teachers Federation recently said that the BC NDP's government's public position supporting teachers and public education have been at odds with the employer's actions at the table for months. What is your perspective on this backdrop that this decision is taking place in? That you say is, of course, being made at the Vancouver School Board level, but coming at a backdrop when there are these breakdowns and talks across the board in the public sector.
The issues that we're talking about, actually, our union has actually signed a new collective agreement, and none of this was raised. And in fact, we've raised the issue with publicly and with the school board that they are suggesting making fairly radical and dramatic changes to the jobs that our members do. That as many as 50 people could lose their jobs in these kind of moves, and none of that was discussed at the bargaining table. So we, in fact, will, if this proceeds, we will proceed to the Labor Relations Board for a bad faith bargaining allegation, and if that's upheld, we'd be in a different situation potentially. But they didn't raise this during collective bargaining, or we might have had a whole different outcome, because this is clearly unacceptable to the union. In terms of the teachers' dispute, and also there's support workers in Saanich, there's no question that there are and always have been dramatic challenges for funding of schools and the balance between increasing wages for teachers and reducing class size and other costs there. And these are things that need to be discussed and debated publicly. In our case, what we're saying, though, is how did the Vancouver School Board management, without any input from students or parents or stakeholders or the public, develop all these proposed cuts and then dump them on the school board trustees as of last night? This is the kind of thing that we should have a discussion about publicly. How important is it for Vancouver schools to offer teaching cafeterias and offer students these opportunities? And we should hear from the restaurant and food service and hotel and hospitality industry and from the students who are taking these programs. And if after that kind of consultation, if the school board trustees don't think it's important, then they have the right as trustees to take a vote on that and decide. But this is not what's happened whatsoever. It's been done in secret. It's been done the wrong way completely. And that's why we're up in arms about it. I think the debate that's going on with teachers and the government and their employers is a valuable one, and it'll be resolved. But I have to say also that the teachers are saying that they do not want to follow the wage guidelines of 2%, 2%, 2%, which other public sector unions have agreed to in collective bargaining. So they have to make a very strong argument to the government and the public in order to get an increase that's above that. And that's up to the teachers and their union to do. But we're having that discussion in public, and they can make their case to the public directly and to the government. In this situation, we've had a secret process without consultation to the degree that when we asked for numbers about enrollment and some of the sales figures, we were denied, and we've now had to go to Freedom of Information requests to the Vancouver School Board in order to get basic information, which shouldn't have been any problem to share at any point in time.
I see. All right.
What a strange way to be brought together. The ones they've loved have been wounded or died.
Everyone dies.
Yes, but everyone isn't killed. In a way, being loved is like being told you never have to die.
Johnny, good luck to Johnny Canuck and all.
UBC Theatre and Film presents Timothy Findlay's The Wars, adapted by Dennis Garnham, directed by Lois Anderson, taking us deep inside the mind of a soldier and catapulting us into the mud, smoke, and chlorine gas of the front line in France in World War I.
Emerging artists tell the story of soldiers and their families, not much older than they are now. Timothy Findlay's The Wars is ultimately life-affirming, proving that human connection is all.
November 7th to 23rd, Frederick Wood Theatre. Tickets for students only $11.50.
Theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
The Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival's fall series is back, presenting an adventure-packed weekend including a mountain bike show that features North Vancouver's Ella D. Brown and Leslie K. Meyer. They'll be talking about the film Bikepacking and Boat Living, A Tale of Traveling by Land and Sea. Film screenings will take place at 7:30 p.m. from November 14th to 19th at both the Centennial and Rio Theatre, with an added screening of the popular Real Rock climbing films on November 17th at 3 p.m. For more info, visit vimff.org.
And we're back. If you're listening to, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview with Bill Thielman, a spokesperson for IUOE Local 964, which represents cafeteria workers at Vancouver School Board schools. So we have a resident high school student here, Ben Nelson. And so I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on the proposals to remove hot meals for needy students and reduce culinary programs.
So I guess I'll start with the culinary programs aspect of it. It's a very popular elective at our school. I think that would be kind of a hard hitter for a lot of kids. I think I may be wrong because I only took it for about a month, but I think you can take it multiple years in a row, so it's really a fan favorite among kids at our school. As for the first point you made, I think, like, obviously people's health should be the most important, so if kids need hot lunch, then they should be getting it.
Yeah. Just to be clear, I think you go to school west of Main Street, so the culinary programs currently at your school are not ones that are kind of part of this cut because they're not done by a Red Seal professional, and they're cutting those. It's literally called a culinary program. But what you said is true. Like, yeah, people, I guess the people where they do have those professionals running those programs, it would be a very popular elective. And But I guess they're like what you have is basically what we call foods, right?
Yeah, so we just call it foods at the school. I don't know if this confirms anything about anything, but our foods teacher also teaches sewing.
Yeah,
so
it's like more of a home economics kind of.
Yeah, idea. Except it's just focused on cooking.
Yeah. That makes sense. All right. And now Adeline has a piece to share about Wildlife Society.
Thanks for your input, Ben. Now we present part one of a series on Critter Care Wildlife Society, a wildlife rehabilitation center in Langley. Let's take a listen. As the days grow shorter, the first autumn chill sets in, and leaves start gathering in seemingly perpetual piles, the joys of summer can seem to be a distant memory. But at Critter Care Wildlife Society in Langley, there's always a bright spot, even as winter approaches. Established over 30 years ago, this wildlife rehabilitation center has been treating, housing, and subsequently releasing injured or orphaned BC mammals. Over the years, they prepared countless animals for re-entry into the wild through the dedication of their wonderful interns, staff, volunteers, and veterinary partners. My name is Adeline Payne. This past July, I stopped by Critter Care's annual open house. I took a tour that gave me a glimpse of the center's various animal habitats, such as the raccoon, otter, beaver, and deer enclosures, as well as the nursery housing infant mammals. The first stop is the nursery. This is the building that houses infant mammals, mammals expecting young, and mammals requiring intensive care. Here, an intern introduces us to the basics of coexistence with skunks.
If you see a little guy, don't touch them because they don't hurt people. They don't want anything to do with people. Unless they're injured or orphaned, you don't need to touch them. They look after gardens, they eat slugs, they eat insects, all the creepy crawlies that ruin your garden. They help you out, so they're actually pretty good little guys. And their spray is not that bad. I have been sprayed 3 times this morning, and I'm still fine. Yeah, that's why I had to get one.
Babies have little poops compared to the adults.
Oh, well, they can pick quite a puppy sometimes, I can tell you that.
Afterwards, we head outside to the raccoon enclosures. Distinguished by their sensitive sense of touch, I learned that raccoons are highly intelligent and possess a good memory. Since they're able to solve puzzles and are good at opening things, Critter Care strives to provide them with various forms of enrichment. In the segment you're about to hear, the term mom refers to the intern that's in charge of caring for specific raccoons.
Trays. We train our raccoons to go to the bathroom and water, so we're not cleaning up poop all over, and they train really quickly. Same way you do a cat. We open the kennel, they have been sleeping all night, their bellies are warm, we put them in warm water, so it kind of stimulates them, and they go, oh. And then they get used to, it's a godsend. Can you imagine all these raccoons? This way we just dump it down the, you know.
How many are in there? I can't see.
I'm not sure how many. Okay, there's a list of names. How many are there?
There are eight. You can hear them, but you can't.
And you'll see the buckets of bleach water. Our interns are very careful about dunking. Cleanliness is a real
problem. Yeah, they do.
And I don't know if you guys noticed how clean this place is. This is not just for today. They have to for the safety of our interns and our animals. So whatever the raccoon moms are, they get the name on. And you'll look at the phone. How do you know these kids? They know. They know which story in there. See all the toys? Raccoons love to play, so we try to give them as many toys as possible. through, you can see more raccoons too. These guys were all sleeping last time we went through, so now they're active.
They're awake, son.
And I mean, this is not their time of day. They're familiar. We've been on here.
Look at them playing,
you
guys. It's improved so much.
Thank you for listening. This piece was reported and produced by Adeline Ping. Special thanks to Critter Care Wildlife Society and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. Thanks for your piece, Adeline. You just heard a piece about the Critter Care Wildlife Society, a wildlife rehabilitation center in Langley. Up next, we have a podcast episode entitled The Intimacy of Voicemails by UPC student and News Collector member Violet Miles. Do you want to intro the piece, or we can just...
I think part of it is kind of like fun to be a surprise, but I'll say that I started this piece. I did it for creative writing class last semester, but... it started with kind of a misunderstanding between me and this woman, Anne, and like sent me on this little journey about voyeurism and voicemails.
Sounds intriguing.
Hi, this message is for Anne. Hi, Anne. This is Heather over at Matt's Pharmacy.
Hi, Anne. This is Rob.
Hi, this message is for Anne.
Hi, Anne. This is Stacy from Georgine the Restaurant.
Hi, Anne. I'm sorry it took so long to get back to you.
Hi, good morning. This message is for Anne.
I've been getting the misplaced voicemails for a woman named Anne for almost a year now. I feel guilty for receiving these voicemails. I've done all I can to try and make sure Anne gets these messages instead of me. I've tried calling people back, telling them that I'm not, in fact, Anne, that they have the wrong number, to please tell Anne that this isn't her number. When that didn't work, I added an answering machine.
Hey there, you've reached Violet. If you're looking for Anne, you have the wrong number. Good luck. Bye.
Surprisingly, I'm still getting messages for Anne to this day. It got me thinking about the intimacy of voicemails. I've spent a year learning about Anne only through the messages left on my phone.
My name's Nabria, and I'm calling from Matt's Pharmacy.
Hi, I'm calling from Matt's Pharmacy. I was calling in regards to a delivery.
Hello, this is the delivery driver for Matt's Pharmacy.
With Jefferson Home Care, call and set up a time to come out tomorrow to check on Nicholas and admit him to home care service and also check on his wound.
I checked everything. I checked underneath everything. There's nothing going on here. Oh, God, this is a sin. I wonder if it's something like a pipe in the ceiling. Oh, God, this is a sin. I'm so sorry you're going through this.
Hi, this is Alexandria with Safeco Insurance. I was giving you a call about the water claim that you filed.
Annie, it's Woody. I just called to say thank you for the note. Annie, this is Woody. I left you a message before. When you get an opportunity, give me a call.
It makes me wonder what someone might learn about me if they stumbled upon my messages without context.
Hey, Violet, it's Joseph. I'm on my way home right now. I was just checking on you to see if you're okay because I didn't hear from you today. Let me know how you're doing. I just want to make sure you're okay. All right.
Hi, Violet. It's Grandma. I don't know if you're back in Vancouver or not, but I just wanted to touch base with you to see how your holiday went. Nothing important. I hope you had a good holiday after I saw you on Christmas. You look beautiful. Okay, honey. Love you. Bye-bye.
Sharing these voicemails made me feel really vulnerable and more emotional than I thought I would get. A couple of those voicemails are pretty old, and I haven't heard the voice of some of those people in a while. Joe was a boyfriend of mine, and I don't know if you could pick up from the voicemail, but that was left basically at the end of our relationship. Things weren't going so good. It was really warming to hear my grandmom's voice. She's a loud Jewish woman, and it's really captured in that voicemail, but it's also captured that she loves me so much. Yeah, I don't know. I think if anyone had these voicemails on their phone instead of mine, I would feel really cheated out of those memories. And it did feel really intimate to hear someone else's voice on the other side of the line. You really feel like you know that person. Yeah, I was surprised by how emotional that made me. I invited a friend to share some of her voicemails with me. Hey, Holly, thank you for being here with me today.
Thank you for having me, Violet.
I have gone through your voicemails, and I've picked out a couple that I wanted to share with you. So do you want to just jump right into it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Hi, Holly. I just want to say good luck on your surgery today. I love you so much. You're going to do great. When you're back, we can turn up the ECAB off. I love you so much. Sending all my love to my Persian sister.
I've never heard that before.
Are you serious?
Well, because I don't check my voicemails. Oh, that's Jasmine. That's so nice.
You knew from the voice, or did she say her name?
No, I know from the voice. I didn't know she said. I'm gonna.
So you've never got that message before?
No, I did. Well, I got it. I received it, but I didn't listen to it.
How would you feel like that? Basically, was lost on you already.
I know.
How do you feel, like, knowing that she sent you that message and you didn't
even
get it?
And then I never knew.
Yeah.
Like, I feel, like, because obviously this is all about, like, the intimacy of having a voicemail. And I just had never thought about it. Whenever I get voicemails, I never listen to them. I only just call the people back. But that was a really nice message. It made me feel really nice.
Okay, I've got another one here for you.
All right.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. Love you, too. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Aww, it's my mom. She also usually calls me boobers, so I'm glad she didn't on that.
What'd she call you, toots?
Toots.
Yeah.
Probably if you listen through all the voicemails of my mom, like, she has, like, 8 different names for me. Mm. She's very into, like, you have to send people messages. Like, my mom is, like, the voicemail person.
Queen.
Voicemail queen.
Yeah, so sweet. And you can just tell that you guys are so close to each other. It's really encapsulated within that.
Yeah.
I have one last one to play for you.
All right.
And it's quite different from the other ones.
Yes, good afternoon. This message is for Holly Hashibashi. My name is Estella. You were referred to me. We're looking for some therapy sessions. If you can please give me a call so we can set up an appointment.
Yeah. Estella, like, changed my life.
Yeah?
Yeah, she's, like, one of the best people I've ever met in my entire life. She's the best therapist I've ever had.
That's amazing.
And I think I only had 6 sessions with her, like, not that many.
Really?
After speaking with her, I became probably the best version of myself, I would say.
When I was going through my voicemails, I had found a voicemail from my therapist. There's something, like, really soothing about hearing her voice.
Yeah.
For me, like, did you get that same reaction?
Oh yeah, she's from Argentina, and, like, I haven't heard her voice since I left in August. I wasn't expecting that to be on my voicemail. Yeah, it was really nice to hear, because like, thinking back as well to, like, when I first got that voice message, I was still in this, like, really weird place where I didn't really know, like, how I was as a person, and I knew I needed help. But, like, now looking at it and hearing it again and being like, oh, Estella, she was amazing.
Yeah. This woman changed your life, and that voicemail was really her reaching out and connecting to you, like, you were referred to her.
Yeah, I was referred to her,
like,
yeah.
What if those wires got crossed somehow? Like, what if someone else got that voicemail?
Yeah.
Like, how does that make you feel?
Well, to think that someone would be getting my voicemails is, like, not the most amazing feeling. And, like, Estella, I think I wouldn't have even had the opportunity if I didn't get the voicemail. I couldn't imagine what it would be like to get someone else's voicemail. But I think it would be kind of fun to get.
Well, that's the thing. You do learn so much about people, like,
yeah,
a surprising amount. I'm your friend, and I feel like I even learned more about you just listening to your voicemails.
Yeah.
Just now.
Now, thinking about it, this was never an issue I thought of beforehand, but it kind of sucks that we don't leave voicemails anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would love to get some voicemails from my friends.
Yeah.
You feel really nice when you hear someone's voice and you know someone's voice.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing these with me and the audience today, Holly.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. What would I find if I looked at your voicemails? What could I learn about you? In a time where we communicate through text so much, voicemails are almost a dying art form. What do they tell us about ourselves? What do they tell us about the people we know and the people we love? How might they capture a moment in your life and preserve it? I may never find Anne to tell her the mistake she's made, but in a way, I feel like I've already found her. Like I already know her. And I know her downstairs neighbor, and her delivery man, and her sick husband. I feel like I'm a part of her life in a distant way.
Wait. We're on air.
Hi. thank you so much for listening to my piece. Like I said, I did that last semester, and I had a lot of fun doing it, and I definitely want to make more episodes like that. So if you like that, stay tuned. Probably not until next semester when I have more free time, but I would love to do more stuff with voyeurism. I've kind of toyed around with what I want to actually do with it. I was thinking like staying with voicemails, but I felt like kind of trapped by that, I think. Yeah, I'm still getting voicemails for Anne, like,
oh really?
Probably on like a bi-weekly basis.
Yeah. Have you like pinpointed her location? Like, is she from Vancouver?
I think I've discovered the problem. I think that she has the exact same number as me, except where I have a 4, she has a 9, and whoever wrote it down for her, their handwriting must have made it look like a four.
So have you called that number?
I got a text from that number a really long time ago that said, your number is my number. And it kind of like, I went back and like found that text and realized that it must have been her. And I was like, no, this is your number. But the message hasn't really gotten across in an effective way, obviously.
So maybe that's her next piece, just your conversation with Anne, and you meet her and you talk
to her. Like tracking her down.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's probably like from where I'm from, like somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Oh, in the States.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Road trip.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be back there in December, so who knows? Bring a microphone with me. Yeah.
So, you have anything to add to that, or?
Yeah, it was really interesting. What did I also? This is off topic, but I took part in a protest for a new math building.
Why did you need to protest the current math building?
Because it's like 100 years old and it has rats and asbestos.
Really?
In the building. So,
have you seen the rats for yourself?
I haven't seen my associates have caught a rat. And my professor has rat traps in his in his office because his he used to have some candy and it got eaten by the rats.
Did you have a lot of classes in that building?
Yeah, well, I had most of my classes in that building. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I didn't see a rat, so they're probably not that prevalent, but they still exist.
Maybe they come out at night.
Yeah,
I've seen some of the rats here around like the hospital area, and they're kind of big, I'm not gonna lie. Yeah, I thought it was like a small cat. I was like, no, that's just a rat.
Yeah.
What would you like to see the university do?
Yeah, I think they should move forward with the plans for a new math building. It's been overdue for a long time.
Are there plans in place?
Yeah, I think like 20 years ago, they were thinking of renovating it, and then they said it was too far gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, okay, we need to start planning for a new math building. But then I think it just, you know,
slip
universities
through the cracks.
Yeah, universities act very slowly, and math doesn't have the same kind of high-powered alumni of Souder or other kind of faculty, yeah. So it's not a super
racking
big priority.
In the cash.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like right next to, you know, the business school too, so.
Yeah, the contrast is,
is immense. A lot of the same could be said for arts, which is really weird because it's like really big faculty, but a lot of like art departments are like really underfunded. I've heard a lot of people in visual arts complain about it. Film production, I think, is pretty underfunded.
I think it might have something to do with like donation from like alumni and graduates from the program. So like, I guess the art students aren't making the big bucks here.
Yeah.
What?
I'm an art student. I
no
can say
way.
That.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. With biology, we have like a bunch of new buildings. So
yeah.
All right. You have to rub it in.
sorry.
Probably all these doctors, I guess.
Yeah.
People have become doctors. They probably
that's true. We have the museum and everything too. So,
yeah.
A giant whale skeleton, you know, pays for itself.
Yeah. probably have a giant skeleton of like the number pi.
I like where your head's at.
Yeah, need to rake in the cash.
We'll have to become famous, rich alumni and donate to our programs. Yeah.
Are there any other headlines that we need to cover or are ready to wrap it up for this week? All right. So there seems to be, we're going to have an early show. And thanks so much for taking the time to listen. It's approximately 5:54 p.m. And tune in again next Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. for more local and undercovered local news.